The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts, sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG from this horrifically named podcast series. QA is the important part. We like to make this an interactive conversation between various social streaming services around the internet and on apps on your phones. We like talking to as many people as we can and not siloing into these little buckets of walled gardens. Welcome, everybody. This show's gonna be really loaded. The internet is melting down around us. And I'm sure we all have a lot of thoughts about what's going on some of these platforms. I'm trying to return to form. The last 2 weeks, we've kind of had some interruptions and some schedule differences. And last week was WWDC, and so we turned that into more of a pre-show podcast. So I have a proper news lineup. Obviously, there's a massive story happening as we speak, ramifications being spread throughout the internet as Reddit is going through some drama. So I will be saving that for the end of the news block where I would normally be plugging my subreddit. I did pull my subreddit. So I want to jump in. First of all, I hope you all had a lovely weekend. It was a challenging one. I really tried to stay unplugged. Like, my daughter is wrapping up her first year. Is wrapping up first grade. And we're coming to the end of her school year, and we're trying to find, you know, like, play dates with friends and summer camps and things like that. And so I was really trying to be there for her, and my phone was just exploding the entire time. Like, trying to keep track of all of this was pretty incredible. So, I just want to say, I've been seeing a lovely group of folks joining on the Instagram. We've got Malik, Coppa Cash, Dave Burns, Hawks, J-Man, Frank Gallo, Clay Lynch, missing some people, McCorkeran, Soar Hunter, Ron Guido, ER1980, Al Sabakli, Gormlord, Barry Johnson, hey there, Engineer Reacts, Mountain Dew Lou, Lamprose, missing Random Hobby, Bionic Scoop, we've got a killer group. John Gao, what's up? Malik, Murder, I actually really like your name, Murder. Because it reminds me of that 30 Rock joke, the rural juror. So we're jumping in. Zach Talks Tech, throwing a little wave. I see Gadget Goddess. We see Kimmy. She's also jumping in there, too. We have so many wonderful people here. This is exactly the kind of crowd. It will be difficult for me in some of these stories to not get a little emotional, because these are platforms and services and communities that we've all spent years interacting with. So we have to do a proper housekeeping, because I haven't done one in a couple of weeks, and I'm honestly not sure if my whole web setup is working here. We're going to give it a try. I had a lot of issues last week doing the best of our week. TK and I did a stream, and I was like, wow, my whole setup is like properly broken. So kicking off, I did post on somegadgetguy.com. I did post just some of the reason for why I'm pulling my subreddit. That's the top post on my website right now. Glowing Rectangle subreddit will also go dark on June 12th. There are dozens of us. Just an Arrested Development joke. Now, fairly, some people reached out and said, hey, you link to the subreddit. And we're like, yeah, I wrote a post on the subreddit to explain some of the reasons why the community there has decided that we should join the protests and go dark too. And then I finished typing that reply and went, oh, I'm a big dork. The subreddit is private. So now in this blog post that I linked to, you can't see what we wrote up on the subreddit. So at some point when Reddit is functional again, I'm going to go back, copy that out, and paste it in there. And we can further the conversation on why that community went dark. Moving right along, I did an editorial on the Apple Vision Pro. The title is Years of Hype for an Expensive Dev Kit. I am very critical of the presentation that Apple put out there. I am very disappointed in the press reactions to a $3,500 VR headset. I've gotten tons of Apple fan hate mail over this editorial, and yet no one really seems to care to address the points I have in the video about why I was frustrated by Apple's keynote. It's just, you didn't try it, so you're a hater. And I feel there are some massive glaring issues with what Apple showed off. And later on in the podcast, if we want to chat about where I feel Apple is right up to the line of almost lying about their competitors' capabilities, we can absolutely have that conversation. Let's see. Moving right along, I wrote an editorial. I had two massive posts on the blog recently that were written articles. The Galaxy S23 Ultra does not cost $469 to make. Stop lying to your readers. And first of all, any situation that makes me defend Samsung, I'm immediately cranky about. But I'm really tired of this yearly game that we play where we got a bucket of parts, and that bucket of parts costs $470. So that's what it costs to make a Galaxy Note 23. And like every year we start playing this game of, well, I guess these tech companies are just out for profits. And they're trying to get money out of their consumers. So I had to defend Samsung. You know how much that hurts me? That hurts my soul. But one of the fun videos that we put out last week and into the week before, camera overheating, has Sony fixed the Xperia 1 Mark V? And I did a full roundup like I did last year, shooting samples at 4K 60 and at 4K 120 frames per second to see how much improved the Xperia 1 Mark V might be over the Xperia 1 Mark IV. And then I did a couple other fun videos. I've done a full sort of in-depth tour through all of the camera apps on the Xperia 1 Mark V and also the new monitor mode. So you can plug the Xperia 1 Mark V into another camera and use that as a display. And there are some huge updates to the external monitor mode on the Xperia 1 Mark V. And then just kind of wrapping up housekeeping here, one more written editorial. I wrote an article titled An Open Letter to Nintendo About Emulators, You're Doing It Wrong. And I actually did write it like a letter. Dear Nintendo, I love you. How are you? I am fine. But also just another opinion piece on how a part of this industry is missing why their potential customers are engaging in sort of what we would maybe consider some form of IP theft. And this all boils down to an emulator that was supposed to go up on Steam. So, oh, Zach Talks Tech says the Nintendo piece was good. I really appreciate that. Again, it was a little more controversial, the Nintendo piece. I got a lot of comments like, well, Dolphin screwed up and they included proprietary intellectual property. And what Dolphin included was an encryption key. I don't know that we've ever tested legally in a court of law if an encryption key can be considered intellectual property. We've been fighting these fights since DVDs were in fashion. And when DVD encryption was cracked, there was a string of letters and numbers that you could put into another piece of software that would then allow you to watch a DVD. It would unencrypt the contents on that DVD. We've never really tested, as far as I know. Someone please send me some case law if we have, because I'm not a lawyer, so I could absolutely have that wrong. But to me, it's kind of like making the argument, someone stole my laptop, and then they were able to drain all of the money in my bank account because they guessed that my password was 12345. So I'm going to sue them for stealing my intellectual property that they guessed my password was 12345. Now, not only am I going to try and have them arrested for stealing all the money in my bank account, I'm also going to sue them for IP theft because I came up with that password 12345. And to me, that's kind of what the argument is. Horrifically simplistic, right? How badly did I boil that down? On a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is Juan just gave us the dumbest sort of analogous example, to 10 being like, wow, my mind was just blown with that amazing comparison that you just made. How badly did Juan just do trying to describe encryption keys as a potential source of intellectual property theft? Anyone? It's Frank Gallo. It's the same as my luggage. Any opportunity to throw out a Spaceballs joke? Dustadore, that's an easy 10. Oliver, that's very kind. I was going to say a 2. Oliver's saying I got a 4. Gormlord is just saying not 0. So I guess I am not the worst. But again, this is what's so tricky, because we haven't actually crafted law around digital constructs. All of our laws are built around a more analog representation and distribution of content. And this is where we always get into tremendous amounts of trouble, is when we apply previous case law and precedent to new emerging technologies, and then we just kind of coast until there's a more significant problem. And instead, we should be more proactive about addressing some of these concerns. It would be better for the rights holders, it would be better for the distribution houses, and it would be better for the customers, because we would have a clearer idea of what the rights and responsibilities are in a market. Every single time people go, oh, but regulation bad, the thing that we always overlook is stability in a market. And this goes true for every single regulatory controversy that we've ever had. If you were against net neutrality, for example, people have heard me prattle on about this forever. If you were against net neutrality and you ended it at the federal level for the whole government, what happened was a bunch of individual states in the United States made their own flavors of net neutrality. So instead of having one fairly weak federal standard, you ended up with a mishmash of individual state versions of that policy. That's bad for companies. If you're pro-corporate, that's bad for enforcing the rights of corporations. It makes doing business more difficult across the United States. Oh, Malik is saying I explained it in a way that a third grader could understand. Well, thank you. I like that. Gormlord. So yeah, this is where one of the things that I got wrong in this editorial, and I have an update. So the first thing you read on my editorial is not the editorial. It's a major update on something that I got wrong, and I left it in the editorial. You can see what I got wrong. Gormlord is saying, didn't Steam kind of preemptively take down Dolphin of their own accord to avoid ruffling Nintendo's feathers? That is not true. Nintendo served Steam a cease and desist. Now, what I say in my article is that Nintendo sent them a DMCA takedown. Digital Millennium Copyright Act is sort of the framework that we use to enforce copyright on the internet. And it's woefully out of date, and it's not as useful as it should be. So I said Nintendo served them a DMCA takedown. That was not correct. Nintendo served a more run-of-the-mill cease and desist, sort of like a warning that if they don't pull it, then further action is going to apply. And one of the things they asserted in their cease and desist was their rights under the DMCA. So I had that completely wrong. And that is a very important legal distinction. They did not serve a takedown. They did assert their rights under the DMCA to send a cease and desist. And then Steam pulled Dolphin from the Steam catalog. So that's a very important bit of nuance as to how all of this went down. Let me get this out of the way right here. Okay, I'm going to take a quick drink of coffee, and I'm trying not to slurp too loud here. And I'm going to kind of put a pin in housekeeping right there. There are a number of other things that have gone up recently on the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. I even recently, it's in early access just for patrons, my first video on the Robo and Kala 2-in-1, sort of a Surface Pro competitor. Oh, hey, was Osman King saying, how y'all doing? And Luther Woodworks, do all phones throttle performance and screen brightness when they overheat? Traditionally, yes. I do a gadget block in the second half of the podcast. Remind me of that question, and we can absolutely spend some time talking about the thermal test that I did with the Xperia 1 Mark V. So, everything that we've talked about, all of my housekeeping and all of the links that we're going to be digging through for the news block and the gadget block, everything's going to be available on this week's show notes for the podcast on somegadgetguy.com. You can also download the audio version of this podcast across the internet with video replay and audio replay and all that fun stuff too. Again, always greatly appreciate folks who are sharing the show. Since we don't have Reddit anymore, that effort is significantly more appreciated. And then also rating podcasts. If you listen to podcasts through some type of downloading service where you can throw some stars, we always appreciate those stars. So let me get this out of the way here. Getting into the news block. We're going to save Reddit for the end of the news block. I want to chew through just a couple of stories, and unfortunately, one egomaniacal billionaire man-child can still occupy so much of our weekly news feed. So I've got two Elon Musk adjacent stories that I kind of just want to pop back to back. The articles are very well written. We've been sourcing. We've been keeping an eye on this information for a while. And as these stories unfold, we just want to make sure we're doing more than just digging into the headlines. The ramifications are actually pretty significant for both, but they're for individual companies. I want to start off with Twitter. Because Twitter was sort of the first social media company this year to just go right down the pooper. Let me get this out of the way. Twitter stiffs Google. Now, this is from platformer.news. Zoe Schiffer and Casey Newton wrote this up. Musk won't pay his Google Cloud bill, and the company's trust and safety systems are hanging in the balance. Twitter has refused to pay its Google Cloud bills as its contract comes up for renewal this month. Platformer has learned, leading to a high-stakes conflict between the companies that could result in Twitter's trust and safety teams being crippled. While Twitter hosts some services on its own while Twitter hosts some services on its own servers, the company has long contracted with Google and Amazon to complement its infrastructure. Prior to Musk buying Twitter last year, the company signed a multi-year contract with Google to host services related to fighting spam, removing abuse material, and protecting accounts, among other things. Twitter has been trying to renegotiate its contract since March, and has delayed payments to Amazon Web Services, leading the company to threaten withholding advertising payments. So after a point, I would like to put this out here for the people watching on all these various platforms. If you go to Google and say, hey, I would like some cloud storage, please, and you give them a certain amount of money, maybe you pay monthly, maybe you pay yearly, and then after you've started that business relationship, when it's time to pay your bill again, you just say, no, I don't really feel like it. Does Google just give you warnings and allow you to use their infrastructure at scale, or do they cut you off? And this is the mind-boggling part of dealing with massive platforms and billionaires and shareholder expectations and the potential fallout of, you know, the ramifications of the stock prices. So why keep letting Twitter function? We're hearing that Twitter is trying to actively renegotiate and break their contracts for their literal physical ecosystem, like the buildings that they lease. They're trying to play shenanigans with how they pay rent. Now, they're also not paying Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud. At what point do these other companies say, you gotta pay the bill? How many warnings would we get if it were an individual or even like a small organization? Like say you ran a not-for-profit with 100 team members and you needed 25 accounts with cloud storage. And then in the middle of your relationship, you said, we don't want to pay that anymore. Let's renegotiate. And Google would be like, nah. In fact, now we've cut ties to all of your Google accounts and you can't get into any of the information in there. We've just shut you down. You tried to like reverse charge your credit card. You're gone. We've nuked your account. So it's a cup of cash. I think Google would cut me off immediately. McCorkerin, see, but this is it. I recently shut off my Google One account. I really wasn't using it. I kind of like OneDrive better, and I hate how Google Drive does file sharing. It pisses me off how it handles multiple account sign-ons. So someone sends me a file. I go, cool, I want to look at that file. Then it goes, you haven't been approved to look at this file. You need to email the person that sent you this link and get permission to see this file. But they sent me the link. And on OneDrive, I go, hey, you want to see this thing I made? Here's a link. And the person who gets it goes, cool, I watched it. It was really good. Because they have excellent taste and they like my work. So McCorkerin's saying an individual might get a couple months of warnings. I don't think so. I just shut it down. I stopped paying. Well, no, that's actually the difference. You're right, McCorkerin, you might be right there. I didn't just like ghost Google because my accounts are wrapped into too many professional issues. So I did turn it off. But the second I stopped paying for Google One expanded storage, my cap just immediately enacted. Like, you now are running near the limit of your Gmail storage and you can't store photos on Google Photos anymore. So I guess maybe they'd give you a little bit of a grace, but I seriously doubt it. I very much doubt that they would get this kind of constant, oh, but you know, it's Twitter and that's like a big platform. Oh, but maybe. I can't wrap my brain around that. I really can't. So, in other Elon Musk adjacent news, here let me just kind of throw that back up here too. This is a more in-depth investigative piece. I'm barely going to be summarizing it. I'm really just highlighting it. I want people to go and read through some of these stories. Whenever disruptive technologies come out, you know, we're going to spend some time probably at the end of this podcast talking about the differences between AR and VR and MR and XR and all these other buzzwords. But, you know, we're super hype train right now on artificial intelligence. We're still super hype train on things like self-driving technologies. And it's easy to kind of get a feel that a technology is doing something that it's really not. We look at language learning models and AI and chatbots, and they're really dumb. They are going to do significant economic damage to the people who rely on them too much, and they're going to do significant economic damage to the people that they displace in the workforce who do a much better job than the chatbots can do. So this one's from the Washington Post, written up by Faiz Siddiq and Jeremy B. Merrill. I'm pretty sure I've mispronounced both of those names, and I apologize. 17 fatalities, 736 crashes, the shocking toll of Tesla's autopilot. Tesla's driver assistance system, known as autopilot, has been involved in far more crashes than previously reported. And this is a pretty in-depth look at the shenanigans of reporting. We want to get excited and hyped about new technologies and new driver assistance and cars and all of this really pushing the boundaries. I was one of those people just super into, can we get to this new like automation, this new like stage three or class three self-driving? Just imagine what that's going to do. We could have one car for the family and I could drop my daughter off at school and then the car could go pick up my wife from work and it could be an amazing revolution in commuting and in travel. We'd redesign the car so that you could do things like, you know, take a nap on an interstate highway. It's just, none of that's really going to happen. Now I'm becoming even more of the cynic. But really, this is pages and pages and pages. This is extremely well-sourced, well-linked. It's got little video elements in there. The Washington Post has put together a pretty comprehensive look at what the reality of autopilot has actually resembled. And when you separate autopilot from more just the Tesla marketing machine, the image is a little bit different. We would still ask or question when autopilot is involved in some type of traffic incident or collision or a fatality. Would a human driver have done better? And this is the fundamental philosophical issue that we're going to have to wrestle with as we get more autonomous vehicles on the road. It's an unanswerable right now. Our entire society is going to have to grapple with these on individual altercations, individual incidents, until we eventually form a framework around liability, who's at fault, how do we handle insurance. All of these things impact just the basics of our society, especially in a car-centric society like we have here in the United States. Clay Lynch, let me just ask Bing about that comment you just made. Dave Burns, you could take a nap on a train. That is true. You know, if we had rail in the United States, that would probably be better. McCorkran, every time there's a crisis with autopilot, all the Elon fans do backflips trying to blame user error. And you know what? Unfortunately, I'm not siding with that argument, but what I mean is that is likely accurate. Someone misusing autopilot is technically not the fault of autopilot. Someone taking a nap in their car and their car gets into an accident is a misuse of autopilot. And I'm sure a number of people, Dave Burns and I have had these kinds of conversations on the Discord too. One of the major issues is simply just naming it. I feel like Tesla has done a disservice to the conversation by calling it autopilot when it should be something like co-pilot, because that's what it really does. Even just the name for someone who is just that little bit less tech savvy, but they want to own the Tesla, it does a disservice to the mental understanding, acceptance of what this technology really does. You've started at the very beginning of its name, somewhat misrepresenting what the system is capable of. And that sets up expectations that then get people into trouble when they rely on automation too much. And this is not insightful at all. I mean, if you've been watching not only my podcast, but following up on all of this coverage of all of these new technologies and AIs and all this stuff, we're calling it things and people think it's doing something that it's really not capable of doing. And when we rely on these systems beyond their actual capabilities, that's where people and businesses get into trouble. So, yeah, Dave Burns, I'm with you, man. I'm mad. Just more rail. I live car light and bike to my local train station multiple times a week. I've been digging more into my e-bike. It is so nice. It is so nice. It's like, oh, I just got to go to the grocery store, and I throw on some bags on the bike, back of my bike, and it's like a mile away, and I didn't have to run my car for it. It really is pretty great. Clay Lynch, Microsoft will see you in court for Copilot. Oh no, I have run afoul of Microsoft's precious intellectual property. No, IP theft gets me again. Oh geez. Oh no. So, Pakistan, this is another good point. We have strict road safety standards, and somehow we have beta and alpha software on the road. This is another difficult challenge, right? How do we accrue more information to improve the technology if it can't interact with real-world situations that the technology would need to handle? And that is a tremendous philosophical discussion. And some companies think they're ready, and some companies were not ready. And I don't know that we can ever approach... I don't know that we can ever approach this level of driver automation without human-piloted vehicles also reporting in some sort of digital fashion to all of the cars around them. When we started talking about this, I said, hey, you know, if we could adopt a system where short-form radio was sending out signals from your OBD2 plug-in, like you could put a little plug, like a Wi-Fi plug, into your car computer, and it would broadcast just like, you know, basic telemetry, direction, speed, and whether or not you're doing like slamming on your brakes, like an emergency situation that can have an impact in traffic that ripples backwards for miles, right? Every time you hit your brakes hard on the freeway, the impact of that can be felt like 5 miles back. Automated vehicles so far have done only an okay job of handling the inconsistencies of human operation. But if the cars were reporting and you had that sort of signal that could bounce off of other vehicles, so car at the top of the hill is slamming on its brakes. Automated vehicle right behind it gets the warning, sends out a signal to all of the cars behind it, and then that ripple is better managed and mitigated, and there's less of a slowdown, there's less of an impact. If we don't have a system like that, I don't think we'll ever have true autonomous vehicle. It's always going to be this halfway step, because we're going to keep playing those little baby steps of, well, let's take this new software out into the field. Oh, okay, well, we've got some issues like that. Let's walk that back. And you're going to do these little teeny, tiny, incremental developer baby steps forever. We'll never really get there. It's like the riddle, like, hey, you know, if you just constantly go halfway to your destination and then halfway, you'll get infinitesimally close to your destination, but you'll technically never get there. And that's kind of how I feel where we are with autonomous vehicles. We're going to keep getting closer, and we're never really going to get there so long as human pilots are also in operation of their own vehicles. Oh, and then McCorcoran, yeah, and it's going to involve proprietary solutions with proprietary code. We had a wireless standard. We had a spectrum, a frequency of air that was going to be dedicated to some form of car communication, and then that got sold off in a recent block. To other carriers, and you know, we needed 5G, but we had the air that was actually going to be dedicated to car communications, and now that's gone. We could have done it. We could have done it at a federal sort of standard for all vehicles. It's pretty rough. I gotta push pause for just a second. Jman150 gifting a tier one sub on the Twitch, gifting a sub to Kyoturosanti. I get that wrong every time. I am so sorry. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the support. That is awesome. And again, all of the contributions and all of the support, especially here on Twitch, where we have no idea what's going to go on with Twitch in the near future. This podcast might not live on Twitch in another couple of weeks. We'll have to see. The internet is a wild and crazy place. I'm going to take just another quick sip of coffee here. Mwah-huh.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r/glowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Oh, Lampros. All right, let's kind of keep chewing through some of this news block. We've got two more stories before we get to Reddit. This is another one where the data and the numbers are the very beginning of a story that we're not entirely sure how all of this is going to play out. So let me pull this up. This is from Antenna. What is the website? Excuse me, coffee burp. Antenna.live. They're pulling analyst data at Antenna.live, and this is a very short sort of editorial on a first look at the impact of Netflix's password sharing crackdown. Netflix has had the four single largest days of U.S. user acquisition in the 4.5 years that Antenna has been measuring the streaming service. Based on the most current data available, Netflix saw nearly 100,000 daily signups on May 26th and May 27th. Average daily signups to Netflix reached 73,000 during that period, a 102% increase from the prior 60-day average. Cancels also increased during this period, but not as much as signups. The ratio of signups to cancels since May 23rd is up 25.6% compared to the previous 60-day period. So that is a very complicated statement to grapple with mathematically. But if we're just looking at signups, since initiating the password sharing crackdown, Netflix is up 100,000 users. Then we factor in how many people have canceled, and the ratio is floating at around 25% in favor of signups, but against cancellations. I really do, and this isn't me saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I really do believe that in the medium term, financially, cracking down on password sharing is going to be a positive for Netflix's financials. When we saw how many people were users of Netflix but weren't paying for the service and were piggybacking on other accounts and things, Netflix has to pay for that server storage, for the costs, for the distribution, for all of those things that manage a live streaming, video streaming catalog of content. So I really do believe getting rid of, this is the corporate speak, this isn't my opinion on people using the service, because Netflix encouraged password sharing years ago and now they're cracking down on it, which I think is grossly hypocritical. But from that corporate perspective, these people are freeloaders, not paying for the service and using just as much of the service as someone who is paying for it. Sorry, that was really long-winded. When we look at signups and cancellations, that does not tell us the quality of customer. So we could see 100,000 signups on the lowest level tier that's ad supported. And we could be seeing cancellations of the most expensive tiers that had multiple accounts associated with them but can no longer function because of the stupid geo-tracking policy that Netflix has put into place. We don't have that data. I am purely and grotesquely speculating. But my family is indicative of that. We had the most expensive 4K, multiple account, four screens at a time, streaming plan. We were paying the $20 a month to keep up with the Netflix catalog. And we scaled it all back. We're now down to the least expensive ad-free plan. It was 720p streaming on one screen. And it's like $10 a month. So we didn't cancel. But Netflix is making half as much money, and we're screaming really loud. We're streaming just as much content at a lower resolution. That's probably less bandwidth that Netflix has to field. But after a point, how many more people are likely going to look at that and say, you region locked our account, so we're going to get rid of our expensive Netflix plan. And instead, you know, as my kid goes off to college, I'm just going to hook him up with an ad supported plan. It sucks. They'll have to deal with commercials, but instead of us paying $20 a month, you now have one account at $10 a month and one account at, like, what is the ad support? It's like $7 a month or something like that. So now you've made less money and we're still streaming in two different locations and consuming as much content. So that to me is what these analyst reports of just, we saw this one number go bigger. It must be better. And that's not how business works. Business money for a corporation as large as Netflix is a lot more complicated than that. So I'm not sure that in the very, very short term this is good news, but I think in the medium term we're gonna see less servers storage, less server and data center overheads. That will probably impact on some of their operational costs, and if they can hold on to some people even when they're paying less, I think ultimately it's going to be a net positive for Netflix. But I wouldn't get it, like, especially like, say you're a Netflix investor, do not take anything that I say as actual investment advice. I am not good at investment advice. But I wouldn't get too excited, like, oh, the subscriber count is jumping. Oh, that's great. Maybe. It's very likely you could sign on 100,000 more people and make significantly less than where they were before. Onscon is saying $8 a month for ads and downloads. That is so dumb. It's okay. Dave Burns. Oh, yes. How wonderful. The one and only metric went up. There's only one metric, I'm sure, that Netflix is ever paying attention to. And it's literally just how many people sign on. All right, and one more news block story that just made me crazy disappointed in the world we live in today. Let me see. Yeah, let me get the headline here. This is coming by way of Shannon Bond writing for NPR. And I caught this, I think I caught a mention of this on KCRW. A public radio here in Southern California, which I'm listening to a lot more now that I don't have Reddit. YouTube will no longer take down false claims about U.S. elections. This is awful. All right, from the article, the Google-owned video platform said in a blog post that it has taken down tens of thousands of videos questioning the integrity of past U.S. presidential elections since it created the policy in December 2020. But 2.5 years later, the company said it will, quote, will stop removing content that advances false claims that spread widespread. Hold on. It will stop removing content that advances false claims that widespread fraud, errors, or glitches occurred in the 2020 and other past U.S. presidential elections because things have changed. It said the decision was carefully deliberated. Another quote from a YouTube representative. In the current environment, we find that while removing this content does curb some misinformation, it could also have the unintended effect of curtailing political speech without meaningfully reducing the risk of violence or other real-world harm. And from every single study we have seen about the spread of misinformation at scale, that doesn't sound like it holds true. To me, I worry, this is purely my speculation. I have no insider information at YouTube. I have been consistently disappointed in how YouTube has handled controversies with creators and with misinformation and using the algorithm to weaponize the spread of bad information. To me, I'm worried that YouTube is looking at certain pockets of communities that used to consume a lot more YouTube content and would engage with a lot more YouTube advertising, and those are starting to plateau, that they're starting to peak or maybe even descend. And if that's the case, well, I mean, right before this upcoming election, you know, as we get into the political season and all the candidates and so, well, we don't want to lose those conspiracy nuts, and we don't want to lose those people that are spreading misinformation, because they probably watch a lot of YouTube. Every time you've been in a Facebook argument with someone who says, well, do your own research, and you know that their research was reading the headline off of an article on Facebook from some crackpot conspiracy theorist, like it wasn't an actual, like, vetted piece of information. So to me, I'm cynical enough that I tend to look at these types of business moves, these types of business decisions, and think, well, what's better for the platform? If it's better for the platform to police information and keep advertisers on board, then we should see a policy head in one direction. But if you don't have the viewers, then it doesn't matter. So to me, I'm worried that this is a stance where YouTube is yet another social media organization that's looking at, well, but how do we keep the crazy people engaged? Because then we've got all of these metrics and all of this watch time and all of this time on site that we can sell to advertisers. But if we just have reasonable people on the platform, they watch a couple videos and then they get on with their life and they go outside and they touch some grass. We need the crazy people who are going to mainline YouTube 24/7, 365 and just leave tons of hateful comments on, like, video games that have women in them. That's what we really need here at YouTube, especially right before a political campaign, because that's going to make us a lot more money if the crazy people are still screaming and shouting and wagging their fists at the digital ceiling. I had a better wrap up to that. My argument kind of fell apart there at the end. Oh, exactly. A Dave Byrne. CNN can't call it the big lie anymore thanks to their parent company's new CEO and McCorkerin. That was actually on the list of other potential topics to talk about, but I was already a little politics heavy. CNN just fired their CEO, who was pivoting hard to the right. We still need to see who CNN is going to replace that guy with. I've just forgotten his name. I posted about it on Mastodon and then immediately forgot him because he is now irrelevant since he is no longer the CEO of CNN. We'll need to see who they replace him with, because not shockingly, the replacement CEO could be worse. Like, they could go, like, just farther QAnon. Like, it could be way worse. But until we see who that is, I'm still calling this a potential net positive for CNN as any kind of platform, even though I feel like they have completely eroded any possibility of me considering them a reputable news source. I love it when people are like, oh, but you're one of those bleeding heart liberal people. You must just listen to MSNBC and CNN and all that fake news. And I'm like, no, I hate them. I hate them. Why can you not hate Fox News if I can hate MSNBC and CNN? Why? Why does that never get across? Oh, no. I mean, like, one of my news articles here is from KCRW. You know, the joke of, like, public radio,
where we all talk like this, really close. And the really interesting ramifications of moving from just cilantro to more of a pico de gallo in this dish was a captivating experience for this reporter's palate.
Like, come on. That's actually really why I like public radio news. It's so soothing. They could be talking about, like, we're at the brink of nuclear Armageddon, but we're using that real soft public radio voice. And you're like, oh, you know what? That's bad news, but I still feel like I could take a nap. Gorm Lord. Wow, I liked that. Dave Burns. Juan, that was good. Al Sabakli, I don't know if he's still using it. Al writes, that sounded like Mr. Mobile. When Mr. Mobile left Pocket Now, and he was trying to spruce up just some of his own production gear, I'm still proud to say that I picked out the microphone that he made his transition with. He moved to an AKG C414, and I feel like I nailed that. I feel like I was listening to his voice and thinking, like, this is going to be the exact right fit microphone for your voice. And again, years of producing voiceover and directing and casting voiceover in commercials and video games and stuff like that, I feel like that's one of the high points. You're like,
you get an idea and you think, this person's voice with this microphone's going to sound pretty good. And every now and then you land like a magic combination. I feel like I got it on that one. Owen Scott, public radio news stations are the ASMR channels of news broadcasting. They totally are. I love it. Oh, I need to listen to that. Okay, so from Poopy Poop, Adam Ragusier, I don't know how you pronounce that last name, rambles about lav mics for an hour on the latest episode of his podcast. I have very strong feelings about microphones like lavaliers. I will listen to that podcast. I will enjoy listening to that podcast. All right, so that does us for the news block, and this is normally where we would take a pause and I would point my web browser to a specific subreddit. I would go through the spiel of every podcast has a subreddit. My podcast is no exception. And I would try to detail the mission of reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Currently, Reddit is melting down. And hold on, let me pull this up here. I can't even load the moderator version of Glowing Rectangles. The banner is broken. All of the content can't be reached. You know, when Reddit does that, oh, sorry, for some reason, Reddit can't be reached. All of it's gone. I can't get into any of it. And Reddit is apparently facing massive issues with the user base, with content, with servers. I don't know if maybe they could even be under some sort of DDoS attack. It's a mess. I started, you know what, we're gonna kind of combine two things that I was going to try and talk about into one story. I got a lot of ire. A lot of people going out of their way to say things like, well, of course, you don't want them to make any money. How are they supposed to run their servers if they can't get paid? All of these freeloaders just want things for free. And that's not the case. Reddit's API changes would have made it basically impossible for another app or another service to interact with Reddit at any kind of scale. When Apollo came out, with the developer of the Apollo app for iOS came out and said, if we do the math on this, we would be charged roughly $20 million a month. Was it a month or was it a year? Regardless, really bad. So not every developer would have been facing that same $20 million bill. But these are really small. I mean, like, my preferred method of browsing Reddit was an app called Reddit is Fun, RIF. There's no way that developer, because I believe it's just a single person developer, would have ever been able to maintain their app under those kinds of API access monetization schemes. It was a poison pill, and I feel it was always a poison pill. It was designed to be a way to punitively restrict third-party access and encourage users of Reddit to only go through the website or through the official Reddit app. And both of those are kind of miserable experiences. So this is that arms race that we see. If Reddit makes advertising too pervasive and too invasive, and there's no way to craft an advertising experience that aligns with the user's tastes, then the user is going to try and find ways around the advertising. If the tools to manage your subreddits aren't in the official Reddit app, we're going to turn to other apps to manage our communities. So this brings me to another couple of snarky comments where people have come out, like, who's really using the API? You're all just complaining because you want things for free, but you're not really using these tools, or you're not really going to be affected by these changes. And that is, again, another shallow, hostile, toxic, confrontational, bad faith take on how people manage and support a community. Reddit is a platform of platforms, and it takes an enormous amount of volunteer effort to keep a platform running. Reddit was almost a part-time job for me. And my community was pretty small. We had just rounded up to 2,800 members. That is not a big Reddit community. That is pretty small. Technically, we were still in the top 20% of all Reddits. That's not huge. That's pretty little. And the amount of time for that community, managing that community, was an imbalance over handling a YouTube channel with 150,000 subscribers, right? That's the labor of love that managing the subreddit was. But to push back against that idea, oh, who's even really using the API? Glowing Rectangles started as an experiment over 9 years ago. It was April 9 years ago. I actually missed our 9-year anniversary, but I was really looking forward to hitting our 10-year anniversary, and I was going to try and make a bigger deal out of that. The very first incarnation of Glowing Rectangles was very limited to a select number of content creator friends. And it was born out of a conversation back in the days when I was regularly guesting on Enabong Edda's podcast, the Bored at Work podcast. We would talk about ways that maybe we could combine some of our efforts or make more of a network of tech reviewers. And, why not give Reddit a try? But the initial incarnation was completely individually grassroots supported. So Bored at Work comes out with a video. They have to go share it on Reddit. And so what happens with any type of self-promotion collaborative effort, and this happens time and time and time again, it is exceedingly rare that people really contribute or really work together. What would happen is, someone would make a video, put it up there, it wouldn't get any upvotes, they'd kind of shrug, go, I guess Reddit doesn't do anything for me, and then they'd leave. So the very first push of Glowing Rectangles was pulling teeth, because it was, you have to demonstrate consistency. Just like you tell people, you've got to go to YouTube and make regular videos and engage with your audience and do all these things, the promotion of those videos would often stop at, well, I tried it once, oh, I guess Reddit doesn't do anything for me. All right, cool. It's cool that you have that thing. Bye! We went through several different moderators. We went through a number of just like changes to try and freshen it up. It took about 3 years before I gave up on a safe place for people to self-promote their own content. That didn't work. If it was a true organic person publishes a video, copies the link, shares it on Reddit, that system was doomed to fail. Every single time. Every single time we try to make it collaborative and we try to support other people, if they don't get an immediate benefit out of it, then they don't invest any other time in it. And it immediately crashes and burns. So about 3 years of bashing my head against my keyboard, I just started looking up. Maybe I can change some of what this platform is supposed to represent. There are all these content creators I care about. I go to my YouTube and I almost never see their videos, even though I am subscribed to their channels. Even though I have smashed these bell icons, they might have 50,000 subscribers. They might have 50 subscribers. I told YouTube I want to see these videos. So instead of relying on YouTube's algorithm to tell me when someone had published a video, which it almost never did, because I should have been getting pings all day, every day, with the number of channels I'm subscribed to, I looked and I saw, hey, there are these tools that I can use that incorporate Reddit's APIs. I can build RSS feeds out of the channels that I like on YouTube. I can merge so that when something pings the RSS feed, it immediately populates that video as a post on Reddit. And I could even get in there in the API and make little adjustments to say, not only do I want you to publish the video title, I also want you to include the content creator's channel name. That's going to be better for SEO. That's going to be better for promoting the content that I care about. And so I started off with an initial list of around 20 YouTube channels. It took 3 years to build something like 100 users, 100 followers, members, subscribers, whatever. About 100 people sort of following the patchwork self-promotion of videos on glowing rectangles. I broke 1,000 in a couple of months by using the API to follow the RSS feeds of the channels that I cared about. Under Reddit's new guidelines, those tools are basically dead. It would be impossible to replicate the progress of a tiny little subreddit like mine under this new scheme from Reddit by charging this much for access to the API. We've already seen how these companies sort of walling their gardens and blocking access to some of their data has impacted other services too, like if this, then that. I feel they went too crazy with their own tools and software and control. And, well, you can make a subscription feed out of making these triggers. That's too expensive. I mean, you really built the product on something else, and that's not what we were engaging with. And so now charging that much for it doesn't make any sense. But those costs are also being applied to services like If This Then That. So when IFTTT is getting a bill from Reddit to say, hey, your API access is this much, so you owe us this much money, IFTTT has to take that bill and then pass those costs onto the people using their service. Glowing rectangles wouldn't have existed without good API tools, without good management tools, and with my ability to jump into a third-party app, manage that content quickly and easily from my phone, not always having to come to a desktop-grade web browser, and then also being able to automate sharing some of the content that I felt deserved more attention. That's what kind of makes me so sad, is it takes that level of explanation to help people understand why at this individual user granular level, user by user, why a move like this is so destructive to the mission of a platform of platforms like Reddit. Not every subreddit is like mine. You know, obviously there are different kinds of communities out there. But when you restrict the tools that those communities have at their disposal, it makes the experience of using that community worse. So you lose the people that are the passionate driving force of engaging in that discussion or sharing that content or promoting and distributing. Like, the entire chain is weakened and it all falls apart. So I posted on Saturday that I had waited till the last minute to what I felt was the last minute to make my decision. And I was really hoping that we'd see some movement from Reddit in walking some of this back or just engaging in a fairer monetization practice. Because I genuinely do believe there could be some reasonable costs associated with accessing an API at scale. I don't think any company has really handled that well, again, in this kind of consumer-facing business model. But you know, Reddit is Fun gets a bill for all of their API pings, and then I pay Reddit is Fun a reasonable monthly or yearly fee to cover those costs, right? That, to me, makes perfect sense. When Apollo is getting a bill for $20 million, there's no number of user subscriptions that are going to work to pay that bill. So I announced on Saturday that after a lot of thought and some reactions from the community, most of the people that were commenting on the posts were in support of also joining the blackout. I have been working on glowing rectangles for over 9 years. That really sucks. And it meant a lot to me that in finally posting that we were going to go dark indefinitely. We're not doing a 48-hour blackout. We're going dark indefinitely. I am not confident in Reddit's leadership. I am not confident in Reddit as a platform. I feel they have burned a tremendous amount of goodwill that will take a significant amount of time, if ever, to properly rebuild. it's just like Twitter for me. It does not matter that there is a somewhat functional website called twitter.com. It does not matter to me that there is a place on the internet called reddit.com. What matters are the people who use those services. The communities at Reddit and the communities at Twitter are what I go there for. So all these people who pat themselves on the back, like, oh, you boycotted Twitter. Look, Twitter's still around. Twitter isn't still around. All of the reasons that I liked Twitter are gone. All of the people that I really engaged with on Twitter, I'm engaging with them on other platforms where I really feel those relationships matter. Twitter is dead. And Reddit has burned so much of the goodwill in a similar fashion. To me, Reddit is dead until I see a consistent and measured approach to fixing the situation from the administrators and the executives of Reddit. And I don't know if anyone else follows all this stuff, but like, boy howdy, should we not have a lot of confidence in their ability to correct course on something like this. Up until like literally shutting all of Reddit down because of all of the issues and all of the dropouts and all of the problems with the platform at present, they were full steam ahead. And there are even reports that they're working on other user experiments that will restrict browser access, so you have to use their app. It sounds like an utter calamity of a situation right now. There's no simple walking this back now. If they reverse course and they just let the API be open and all these apps can function, or if they come up with a better or more reputable or more equitable, I should say, plan, I'll probably reinstate Glowing Rectangles. But they have shown me how little regard they have for the users and for the developers and for the moderators. And so I'm not going to come back to Glowing Rectangles and put nearly as much effort if they can just pull the rug out from under us in another year. If they think like, oh, well, we can just reinstate this stuff and then lobster pot some of these things, so the changes aren't as dramatic, they boil up slowly, I'm not going to invest in Reddit. I'm not going to support the platform. I'm always going to be anxious that when they come back, if they come back from this, but when are they going to try and bring it back? When are they going to try and do it again? So, you know, I'm hedging my bets. I might dip a toe back in, but it's never going to be the same commitment that I had. And that kind of kills me. I got the replies from people after posting it public that we were going to go dark. And I mean, it really meant a lot that apparently this little enthusiast community had meant so much to so many people. I got stories of people saying, like, I got my first 100 viewers because someone shared a video on Glowing Rectangles, or I was able to build part of my channel up by people interacting with my content. You know, someone else shared it, and then I got into the comments, and I had a wonderful conversation with someone that then subscribed to my channel. And it was small. My subreddit was always going to be a tiny part of the overall tech conversation by design. I never wanted it to be one of those like front page subreddits. I always wanted us to kind of be a little quieter in the background, just supporting, but not like taking credit for supporting. And in my dreams, if it had found just a little bit more momentum from people organically using it, it would have been one of the first feeder subreddits. So if something is popular on Glowing Rectangles, you should share that on our Android, or you should share that on our technology, or you should share that on our iPhone. You know, I wanted it to be that place where other people on Reddit could farm easy karma by sharing the content that we popularized. And it was finding some of that. You would see a video from someone with like 5,000 subscribers would kind of climb the ranks at Glowing Rectangles, and then it would be over on our Android. Or especially, like, there was a kind of a direct feeder on a lot of things like Android gaming, that subreddit, which I frequented a lot. Or the other ones, like our Samsung Dex. We saw a lot of cross-traffic between some of those smaller enthusiast communities really looking at focused content. I'm really going to miss it. I really liked sitting in the background and watching people build and watching, because it didn't even matter if it was like a really popular YouTuber with a million subscribers, or if it was someone with like 50 subs, that folks would come and share. I got so many amazing submissions. It was gratifying to me that it was my replacement for the YouTube subscription process and the YouTube algorithm. Just from a personal standpoint, someone I cared about put out a video, I want to know about it. And I would get that from my subreddit. How cool is that, to have like used this public platform to make a kind of a janky but functional tool to fix something that was broken on the world's largest video distribution service? And I did it. It took me 9 years. It took me 9 years to get it right, but I did it. And Reddit's moves here are throwing a giant wrench in the machinery, and it sucks. So many times this year we've had this conversation of, this platform started by being cool and being free, then users approached it at scale, then they had problems figuring out how to monetize. When they started monetizing, it was wrecking all the goodwill of the community, but people had poured so much time and effort into building things for those platforms. Well, there's the sunk cost fallacy of like, well, I can't give up on it now, even though it's run by crazy conspiracy theorists or something like that. And so they don't pull it, and then it just sort of withers. Like, what made it interesting and cool and fun and interactive and collaborative just sort of erodes and decays. It really sucks to have put 9 years into this. And I'm not ending it on my terms. I'm not passing it off to someone else who would want to take up the mission of what Glowing Rectangles represents. And it's also just that little bit galling that so many people have come out. I mean, the vast majority of people have been positive and supportive and have also been joining this conversation about other ways that we can promote and share content. And that's been beautiful. But then you still have that like little cadre of bootlickers that have to like try and yuck everyone else's yum, or you know, wag fingers in people's faces, or, oh, you're just doing this to be dramatic. Or the number of times people say, well, Juan, you're just bitching about stuff and you need to not do that. And your tone is problematic. And like, fine. But there's no data to suggest that anything good is going to come out of this. And as a one-off, maybe we would say, well, let's see what Reddit does. But in the entire history of social media, we keep running into this same brick wall off of the problems of user data and monetization and security and privacy. And how do we keep advertisers on board? But how do we also encourage speech? But then also, how do we police weaponized misinformation? And it's such a huge problem. And we can't. We always have to have that little group of people that are just like, no, I don't think so. Nuh-uh. And you're like, that's not discourse. Like, you've not contributed to this conversation. It's like what Adam Sandler movie was it? Thank you, everyone is now dumber for having heard you say that. It's really sad. It's really frustrating, and it's really sad. So I don't know. McCorkran, this is a case study in how capitalism ruins everything.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey there, Juan, and hey there, you. This is Jason Howell from All About Android over at the twit.tv podcast network. Juan has been a guest on All About Android a number of times. In fact, we have awesome guests on the show each and every week. And we'd love for you to check out the show if you haven't already. Twit.tv/AAA is where you can go to find new episodes of All About Android. Each and every week, we talk about the top Android news, hardware, apps. We have a reviews portion called The Arena. It's very competitive, but in a fun way. We have a really great time doing this show, and we would love for you to join us sometime and check it out. We get journalists from throughout the Android world joining us. We even sometimes get Googlers who are actually making Android on the show to talk about what we love so much about the world of Android. That's twit.tv/AAA for new episodes of All About Android each and every Tuesday. All right, Juan, back to you.
I don't know where to go next. I still believe in the mission of my subreddit. I believe algorithmically sorted social media is toxic. It doesn't matter if it's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or YouTube. There is no team or platform or team, hashtag team YouTube. There's no one site that we should be supporting just because we're a fan of the platform. All of these platforms exist to monetize user behavior. And one of the most important metrics that they can engage in is keeping people on site. Time on site and watch time are two of the most critical aspects of any monetized, algorithmically sorted social media site. Well, I mean, we see sort of the intense effects of that as we debate, you know, oh, but is TikTok bad for the children? All of it is. As soon as Instagram went algorithmically sorted and prevented my ability to see content in real time, my use of Instagram plummeted. When Facebook did it, my use of Facebook plummeted. The way that YouTube mangles my subscription list and I have to actively go looking for new videos from creators that I care about, my use of YouTube has plummeted. And that's why I was so passionate about my little subreddit, because it was the only place I could find when people published articles and distributed videos and reacted to news and current events. It was happening in real time. Twitter's attempts at algorithmically sorting their content are disastrous because they're basically just putting up people that I never would have followed into my timeline, into my feed, and it's all broken. So I don't know where we go next. Your favorite content creators need a lot of help. If something is not already immediately and intensely popular and is already funded by the marketing departments of massive corporations, it is fantastically difficult to get content out to people who have subscribed to your channel. I can point to the data. I can't, because Google also sort of makes it against the terms of service for me to give you too much insight on my own user metrics. I mean, just consider how screwed up that is. I want to show you how my channel functions so that we can build a better understanding of where I'm coming from and what issues I have with my platform and where some of my bias as a human being and my preferences come from. And I feel like me being able to disclose that would enrich the content creator audience relationship. But Google doesn't want you to have too much information about what goes on behind the scenes at my channel, even though I want to share that with you. So, all of these channels are struggling. The largest channels are seeing a drop-off in their views. The smallest channels are really trying to find what hooks they can keep people coming back and interacting. You have to be operating under constant churn, and your content has never been more disposable than it is today. You made a great video for us yesterday, and it did great. Got like 30,000 views. What are you going to do for us tomorrow? All of your current videos are dead. And no one can function like that. You can never take a day off. The ebb and flow of me doing some sponsored videos puts gaps in between some of my video distribution, and you can see the immediate plunge when I don't have a hot new video to put out, when I don't have this new editorial to talk about, when I'm not reacting to something. Reacting, I need to do wacky face thumbnails every day. And I've got 150,000 subscribers, and I'm reaching maybe 1% of them at launching a new video. No one can function like that. And so if we don't take our viewership off of the platform to show companies like YouTube that you care about this content, more and more of our favorite content creators are just going to bounce. We've already lost so many great commentators and tech literate folks in this space over the last 2 years. It's just gonna keep scaling up. We're gonna keep losing more. So it's always with profound thanks and gratitude. When I say things at the end of my videos, like, thank you for watching and sharing and subscribing and doing all those things that click with the YouTube algorithm. But it is completely unsustainable. So I'm not going to be the one responsible for fixing it. I really do feel that at some point, the entire industry that we're kind of a part of and that we're fans with will just kind of go belly up. I think it is just going to fail at some point, but I'm going to ride the train until it does, until it doesn't make any sense for me to keep producing and promoting and doing all of this work to try and tread water with this system. But in the meantime, we have just lost a significant tool in helping us spread the word. Not just my subreddit. I mean, Reddit in general, and the way that Reddit handles API access. My Glowing Rectangles was a good subreddit. I'm going to pat myself on the back for that, but I'm not saying just my subreddit. I mean Reddit as a total package tool of discovery and distribution and sharing and popularizing and promoting the entire infrastructure of Reddit from the back end and the APIs to the front-facing consumer experience. We've kind of lost that. And so now we need to figure out some other place to go. Increasingly, I have spent a lot more time on Mastodon. Because again, I'm looking for a social media site that does not algorithmically destroy my feed and that I can regularly keep up with topics and conversations easily. The way that Mastodon uses hashtags is delightfully old school. But if you go to Mastodon and you don't see anything in your feed and you don't know who to follow, you type in hashtag Android and you'll get a feed full of Android-related stories. And you can start there. Hashtag gaming, and you get a feed full of gaming stuff, and you can start finding individuals to follow there. So in the short term, that's going to be one that I'm going to invest a little bit more time in because of how safe it is from one executive or one PR team from manipulating the feed of what I see in Mastodon. You can't control a group of platforms like Mastodon, like you can wreck Twitter. So that's where I'm going to be spending more time. Obviously, I mean, if someone hits me up on Twitter, I'm still going to like say, hey, what's going on? And I've kind of been doing fine with just occasionally sharing like the links of my articles or the links to my videos. Like, it's Twitter, and that's about the bare minimum I feel comfortable using Twitter to do. I'm not looking to start conversations. I'm not hosting Twitter spaces. I'm not, you know, trying to popularize the platform anymore beyond just using it for what I've kind of just found coasting on Twitter. But Mastodon is weird and old and funky, and it's kind of a mess, and I kind of love it for that. It feels like old social media in the Web 2.0 phase of the internet. And so I'm going to go back to that just for the warm, comfy blanket of familiarity. I'm not expecting everyone to join me, but if you do, hit me up and let's build a little community and follow some of these topics and share content that we care about. The mission of Glowing Rectangles can still live beyond this one little subreddit getting shut down. But it can't if people don't act. That's always been the biggest problem. Glowing Rectangles didn't become Glowing Rectangles until I automated part of it. I can't automate Mastodon. Like, I'd immediately get kicked off of Mastodon if I did kind of the same thing. I don't know what the immediate solution is for me to just populate a feed of content that you want to see like I could on Reddit. But I feel if we all work together and we all boost each other's posts and submissions, then we can have a significant impact. I mean, literally, the 60 people watching these streams, actually almost 70 people watching all of my various streams right now, if you posted to Mastodon twice a week and we all shared each other's posts, we would be responsible for roughly, let's say we narrow it down to one topic like Android. If 70 people twice a week were posting about hashtag Android, we would be responsible for something like 30% of the traffic on Android-related stories on most Mastodon servers. That's incredible. We would be reaching an audience of roughly a million spread out and federated users, and then the secondary impacts of those stories getting boosted would probably reach an even larger audience, a potential reach of something like 5 million. Sure, Blue Sky is out, and it's a nifty little app, but it's basically Twitter, but slower, and also with far fewer people really using it, right? So there's already a social media platform of social media servers that is ready for more content, and that could be distributed in a very easy way. It would be basically the same as how you would share stuff on Twitter, but you'd be able to reach an audience that's kind of hungry for more content. Right? So that's kind of why I'm leaning in that direction. I also want to throw just a quick pause here. TED Talks Tech, subscribed with Prime on Twitch. They've been subscribed for 18 months. Ted, thank you so much for supporting the content and the production on this channel. Dave Burns, my only worry of federated social media communities is that the internet just becomes the Holy Roman Empire where every fandom is just super toxic to each other. Maybe we need to rethink social media. So that is absolutely a concern. The other concern is anyone can make federated servers. So there are talks about other social media services like Facebook looking at federating so that people on Facebook can immediately transition into other federated communities. Excuse me. So we got to be careful that a massive tech company doesn't look at ways to sort of wall off the garden of what federated means. They could go in and say, oh, hey, have you been hearing about this Mastodon thing? You can interact with people on Mastodon and we'll closely control the experience through Facebook. That would also be real, real bad. But I think the other thing that we probably need to look at, and where I completely agree with your point about needing to rethink social media, is younger people today are not interacting with platforms the same way that we came up with, like Facebook and MySpace. That's already there. Generationally, the idea of social media is already being rethought. And that's where we see the rise of community building tools like Discord, or just, you know, having a thread of all of your closest friends in something like Telegram. It's already being managed. You know, maybe I don't care so much about trying to go viral on a platform that now prevents people from easily going viral. Instead, what I really do need are just better social and collaborative tools for the people that I really interact with. And so that's already a part of it. You know, I run a little private Discord. It is my safe space on the internet. It is a wonderful community of geeks. I love it. But I don't put it out there to be public. I'm not trying to promote using that Discord. That is a personal resource. And for hopefully like-minded tech fans, just to kind of hang out and chill. The problem is that we can't rely on solely a Discord model to help content creators. We need something that can be public and aid in discovery so that people from outside the communities can discover the content that's hosted within the communities, and then we can build and grow our ranks and refresh the number of tech fans that we're sort of losing in the current YouTube strategy. We're not refilling our ranks. We're kind of shrinking our viewer base. We're kind of shrinking our user base because of the way that algorithms sort this content for us. And it's why so many of these communities just immediately descend into like outrage and drama, because that keeps people animated and engaged and keyboard worrying. And, oh, this person had the take totally wrong. I hate what this person said about this thing that I'm passionate about. Let me share their video a whole bunch and leave a bunch of comments on their video so that the algorithm knows I am displeased. And the algorithm doesn't care if you're pleased or displeased. They just want more people to watch the stuff. So anytime you helped to popularize outrage traffic, then it just encourages the business model of getting more drama traffic. Whew. So, short story incredibly long, catch me on the Mastodons. I'm at some gadget guy on the Mastodons. I'm going to take just a quick drink of coffee here, and we can get on to the gadget block, because I have some more sad news in the gadget block. Ooh, real quick. Ted Talks Tech asks, are you going to use your NAS to host your server on Mastodon? So I'm probably not going to do that, but I might talk to my web hosting for some gadgetguy.com, because there are some WordPress tools where you can federate a website. So I might do like a some gadget guy blog account that is technically its own federated instance. Not, again, I don't know that people will be able to follow it. I mean, I'm not sure that people will be able to join that instance, but it could then be shared to other servers as an easier way to distribute content from my website. It's messy. See, this is what I love. It's like, it's funky, and some of these things really don't work. Like, some of the platform on Mastodon is, in the modern age of web convenience, fundamentally broken. But it's exciting. And there are things that you can do that you can't do on other social media sites. And some of the instances and some of the servers run different tool sets and have different communities and different groups of people. And I'm reaching out to artists' communities and trying to follow more people there. I'm reaching out to photography communities and following more people there. And it feels like old Google Plus or old Twitter. And I'm really kind of sad that I didn't kind of get involved a little bit more. I had a Mastodon account from years back. And again, I kind of fell for some of that, oh, but it shouldn't be this difficult. And it's really hard and it's super techie. And I was getting a lot of traffic on Twitter and I kind of just let it fall apart. But coming back to it and setting it up in earnest and really playing around with the tools that you have and some of the resources that you can use, it is so much more open. Oh, it's so nice. And also, the Mastodon app sucks. So if you're on an Android phone, I would highly recommend using Tusky, T-U-S-K-Y. It kind of changed my life, and it's even better at doing things. So like, I'll post a photo on Flickr, because I'm old, and then I'll share the photo from Flickr to Tusky, and Tusky properly grabs a nice thumbnail of the photo from Flickr to embed in the post on Mastodon. And those kinds of interactions, like, that's why you need a good app. You need a better tool. If I just copy the link from Flickr to mastodon.techhub.social on my web browser, it doesn't properly populate a card for people to see a preview of the image. So, like, again, Mastodon is kind of broken. And if you just go through the sort of surface level tools of what the platforms are hosted on, you don't get the full experience of really using it. But then a third party app like Tusky solves all of those issues and it gets you a lot closer to that polished social media experience that we should expect from a modern day web service. So that was a lot of talking. Oh, and Murder, agree on Tusky. It's good. I mean, it's really a good app and it's hilarious because, like, you know, Blue Sky is this Twitter clone, and you launch Blue Sky, and then you look at a picture of a blue sky with clouds. So it's already not blue sky, it's cloudy sky. And then you wait for it, and then it opens your panel, and then it populates your feed, and then you can kind of get in and start using it. And Mastodon is this hodgepodge of like Web 2.0 federated server plans. Every instance is sort of hosted by its own storage solution. It's not one unified platform. And I push Mastodon and I'm immediately browsing content. Populates like that. Tusky is so good. I'm going to be obnoxious about this. I really want techies to try it. Like I said, I've got about 70 people sort of across all my streaming sites right now checking out me rambling about tech and politics and Reddit and all that stuff. If you're the tech enthusiast, give it a try. I'm not expecting your great-grandmother to be able to jump into a Mastodon instance and start working with server and federated content. But if you're the techie, I don't think this stuff is difficult, and you should give it a spin. So, Dave Burns, what are you, Tusk-averse? Colonel Corn Pop. First of all, I really like your name. That's just fun to say. What if we all just went back to email chain threads? We're getting close to that, man. And TED Talks Tech is, again, is going to be really sad. Reddit is where the Google road ends when someone is searching for nuanced solutions. Again, it's such a huge resource to have all of that content go dark. All of the problems that I've solved in tech support where I've been searching for something and then someone in a random Reddit comment thread from like 6 years ago was able to solve that issue. So I promised you that something else was making me cranky, was making me sad. And this is a move from Logitech, now that we're in the gadget block. This is written up by Steve Dent over at Engadget. Logitech retires the Blue microphone brand. So from the article, Logitech is getting rid of the Blue microphone brand and will now sell the products under the Logitech G Gaming brand, only keeping the Blue name to describe our technologies. Blue has been removed from Logitech's section on its website, and the bluemic.com domain now directs to Logitech. This guts me. I am so sad about this. So before I was some gadget guy, I was some audio guy. And some audio guy mostly talked about voiceover performance, casting, commercials, directing. But some audio guy started this trend of reviewing products. And this is like the heyday of home recording, and people could record podcasts and interviews and do their voiceover auditions and some of their voiceover sessions from the comfort of their home offices. And I did so many microphone reviews. When you think about a company like Blue, you probably think about mics like the Yeti and the Snowball. But people constantly forgot that they made some impeccable, some absolutely gorgeous large diaphragm condenser and studio grade microphones. Like the ones you have to plug into a full interface and a mixer and a preamp and a compressor and like real studio grade kit. And a couple years ago, I sold off some of my microphone collection and two of those mics, I'm still kicking myself today that I ever sold them. I had a Bluebird, a Blue Bottle, and a Kiwi. The Blue Microphones Kiwi. This giant tube, green casing, large diaphragm condenser, and it was just an electric sounding microphone. I loved the sound of that mic, but I really wasn't using, those are the kinds of mics I can't even use here in my home office. So Logitech buys out Blue, and obviously Logitech buys Blue because they want all the USB mics. And you're like, that's not what Blue was really good at. The everyone's Snowball was this easy starter mic, but it really wasn't a very good USB microphone. If you knew what was up, you would buy something like an Audio-Technica AT2020 USB for around the same price, or it was a little bit more expensive, but not prohibitively so. The AT2020 USB back in the day was like the people who knew got that mic. The people who just walked through a Best Buy and wanted to have a gooder microphone would get the Snowball. I'm being real snarky about that. I hated the Snowball. So that's a personal issue. I would go into voiceover actors. People would hire me to go to their homes and help them fix their home recording setups. And you would walk in and you'd see like people would put like, you know, egg crate up on the walls and try and make like a little bit of a baffle or a room within a room. And then you'd walk into their space and you'd see a Snowball. And you're like, I mean, that's most of your problem right there. If you want your sound to be better. Oh, Dave Burns. Dave Burns saying the Kiwi was his first microphone. Oh, buddy. Yeah, the Kiwi was so good. It kills me. It kills me that this is kind of the direction. Again, it's like this race to the bottom. so many of those great recording brands. AKG, you know, I was talking about Michael Fisher, AKG C414, one of the all-time best reference grade studio large diaphragm condenser multi-pattern microphones the world has ever seen. I have two of the older C414 XLSs up in my bookshelf right now. They just don't make mics like that. They just don't make them like they used to. You have to now go to increasingly more boutique or just to a couple of manufacturers that have kind of weathered that reputation. Like Sennheiser and Neumann, yeah, absolutely. Pick yourself up a U87 or a TLM-103, even a TLM-102. You've got an incredible recording experience. Those mics, bulletproof. They're gorgeous. Awesome. I love Sennheiser. I have two MKH 416s. But we had a much broader and more diverse sort of class of recording technology. And so losing Blue as a proper standalone label and knowing that Logitech's main investment was for more gaming gear and USB gear, and it just makes me sad. It makes me really sad. It's why I kind of hold on to companies like Rode as much as I do. Yeah, they've got a lot of USB gear, but they still hold on to their legit studio grade equipment too. But every now and then you still lose something. Like I've got a Rode Classic 2. It's like when it launched, it was like a $3,000 tube microphone. Like it has this giant breakout box that you use to control the mic, and then that runs through a whole bunch of proprietary cabling and then goes into your interface. And that mic is just butter. It is so warm. It is so rich. I mean, $3,000 is a lot to spend on a microphone, but that you listen to it and you're like, okay, I know where I would put this mic. I know why someone might spend a lot of money on this microphone. And we keep losing those nuances and those little flavors like that. So in a day of sort of pontificating on the demise of Reddit's communities, we also get to leave an F in chat to pay our respects to Blue Microphones, an absolutely phenomenal recording resource for years, for literally decades of studio and home recording. And it makes me really sad. It makes me really sad to lose that option. Oh, Dave Burns. This is actually a company that I think will probably stick around. He's saying, I still think that one day if I ever got to be like a creator, I would love to have an SM7B. So I believe Shure microphones will stay on that list too. Like Neumann and Sennheiser, you just can't get away. Like I still have it. Ooh, I can't move it because it's tucked behind my monitor. But I still have I want to say it's now like a 30-year-old SM57 is what I do most of my direct voiceover off of. And so an SM7B, even if they decided to pull the plug on it tomorrow, you would have 30 years of SM7Bs out in the ecosystem that you could buy. you sure could pull the plug on all of their mainstream stage and studio microphones today, and you would be able to buy them for decades and service them and repair them and restore them, not a problem. So don't worry too much about an SM7B. They ain't going anywhere. Oh, Fat Produce gifting a tier one sub to Aditya Anil. Thank you so much, buddy. Andrew has always been a phenomenal supporter. He and I have even recorded some podcasts together. He's a really good dude. And I appreciate the support and hooking up Aditya on the Twitch. And hopefully Twitch doesn't crash and burn next week because, man, that's going to make things real awkward. So I also just want to talk about some happier news real quick. And we don't have to spend a lot of time on this because I don't do tons of leaks and rumors. But this one coming by way of Android Authority. Let me get this here. Okay. Exclusive. These are the leaked camera specs for the Google Pixel 8 series. And so a leaker who has some pretty good track records on detailing phone hardware says they've got the scoop on what cameras are going to be in the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro. And if this is accurate, I think we're in for a pretty solid year for the Pixel 8. So on the Pixel 8 Pro, it is getting better companion sensors, and it's increasing the sensor size on their main wide shooter. So 50 megapixel GN2, that is a 1 over 1.2 inch type sensor. I believe this is the sensor that was used on the Xiaomi Mi 11 Ultra. So it's just shy of the 1-inch sensors that we really like on the Oppo and the Vivo and the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. The telesensor, I think it's the same as what's on the Pixel 7 Pro. So I don't think that's going to change significantly. But then the ultra-wide is also a higher megapixel, 64-megapixel sensor, but obviously to bend down to like a 16-megapixel image. Now, that changes for the Pixel 8, though. It's going to have the same main sensor. It's going to have that massive GN2, but it looks like they're going to reduce the sensor size and the resolution for the ultra-wide. And there's no telephoto on the Pixel 8. So that might be a little bit bigger of a difference between the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro. If the Pixel 8 Pro really does land those sensors, that thing's going to be a monster. That sensor is a step above what's on a Galaxy Ultra. I was astounded by the photography quality of the Samsung GN2 when I got to take the Xiaomi for a test drive. It produces images that are a step ahead of what we consider to be a really big sensor now. So it's a larger sensor than what's on an iPhone Pro. It's a larger sensor than what's on a Galaxy Ultra. It was a sensor that was beating out phones like the Vivo X70 and the X80. The GN2 is a monster. It is a very, very good piece of photography hardware. I'm such a big fan of 1-inch sensors now. Like, just knowing that it's going to be a little bit smaller.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a megapixel coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious megapixels. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
That does make me a little sad. Like, it's a shame they couldn't. But also, Google is so tied into Samsung right now that I doubt they would have gone with their main sensor being like a Sony joint. The ultra wides, I believe, are going to be Sony's. I'm not sure about the telephoto. I'm pretty sure the telephoto is also a Samsung, is also an ISO cell. Actually, this is another just like little piece of breaking news. Xiaomi has just announced that the Xiaomi 13 Ultra is going to start shipping internationally. So the international versions of the 13 Ultra are going to be going out soon. I don't know exactly what the timetable is on distribution. But this so far, I think, is still taking probably my top spot for photography. Except for very specific instances, like where maybe you're trying to shoot a lot of action, then you should go with a Sony. But for the image quality, the sensor quality, and what you can do to those images, boy, howdy, the 13 Ultra has been rocking my socks. I would say maybe the Oppo is kind of a close second, with the Vivo being a close third. And now we'll have to see how Google can shake that up, because I think the Pixel 8 Pro is going to be hitting really hard in that space too. So if you really care about like your composition and your depth of field and trying to create an image, not just do like point and shoot social media stuff, those cameras have been incredibly impressive to play with. So if we can bring some of that hardware to Google's beautifully streamlined point and shoot experience, that I think that's going to be a winning combination. I hope these rumors are accurate, but I think it will be just a little bit more of a sting for people on the Pixel 8, not having quite the same sensor capabilities on that ultra wide. Oh, what's up? Jeff just jumped into the chat with subscribing at tier one. Jeff has been subscribed for 47 months. Gets a full. Thank you so much, buddy. Thanks for dropping by. Thanks for jumping in. And again, all of the support and the contributions. Jeff was one of our moderators at Glowing Rectangles. Jeff put time into helping me manage that subreddit. Jeff is a good dude. And when Jeff talks about interactions with social media and building audiences and collaborating with creators, the dude lives that as lifestyle. It's not that he's just like, oh yeah, I'm kind of a YouTube guru, you know, so I'll tell you, I'll give you the advice on what you need to do to fix your channel. No, like the dude is legit and also does some of the best headphone reviews available on the internet. So you should absolutely be subscribed to his personal, his headphone review channel as well. Yeah, Jeff, man, it gutted me. Absolutely gutted me. So we'll have to see where we go to hang out. So, from El Librito de Tri-10, sorry, the Pixel 8 will probably solve the shortcomings Xiaomi had with the GN2. I live within shooting RAW on my Mi 11 Ultra. Pixel's computational photography shooting should be interesting with the GN2 sensor. It's a wonderful sensor. And I would be curious, I mean, I'm sure like just the slab of light gathering tech is probably the same, but I'd be interested, like, is Google going to be able to do other things better with, like, buffering? Because, like, I don't want to lose features from the Pixel 7 Pro, but that is a very taxing kind of video shooting scenario, where the Pixel 7 Pro is still the only phone that can switch camera sensors while shooting 4K 60. So you can smooth zoom from the ultra wide to the main sensor to the telephoto all in one clip. And I hope that moving to something like the GN2, which is a little bit older of a sensor now, doesn't impact what Google has been able to polish up, because it's a really, really sleek interface for just like really good HDR point and shoot style photography. So we're getting down to sort of the last like less than 15 minutes here. I really didn't feel like rehashing my thoughts on some of the other topics that were big news last week. Obviously, WWDC was sort of one of the main talking points. If you want a more in-depth reaction to how I felt about WWDC, and also how TK Bay felt about WWDC, we did our Thursday night podcast, and about half of it, it was a long show for us. It was like, we try for 90 minutes, and that week's episode, we went out to 2.5 hours. But I was very disappointed with Apple's presentation for Vision Pro, and I was very disappointed because it feels like yet another instance of Apple casually misrepresenting their competitors' products. Not outright lying, but making these pithy little side comments about the state of virtual reality, mixed reality, and augmented reality that aren't really true. And the reason why I get frustrated about that is because if other companies were so casually dismissive of a new product and an ecosystem that already exists. So they're launching a new product into an ecosystem that already exists, but they're casually misrepresenting the capabilities of products that already exist. I feel any other manufacturer would probably have been picked apart more by the tech press. And I'm not trying to out anyone, But I also find it a little troubling the number of friends that I've reached out to just for clarification on what they were shown at WWDC. They got invited to go hands-on and put the Vision Pro on their heads. How little they can really divulge or share. I got into one sort of not heated, but a quick back and forth where putting the ball in their court, replying to one of their tweets about me being an Apple hater, went radio silent. And this is an easy one. Like, I went to him and said, I would just like to know more. If I'm obviously missing something, this is an opportunity to kind of help correct that. I would love to know what you saw that changes the reactions that people had who were critical of Apple's presentation. And then I've never heard back. Like, vanished from that conversation and from that thread. So that's the drama of an Apple keynote. You know, Tim Cook goes out on stage and says, augmented reality is a profound technology. And then they showed us no augmented reality. They showed us none. They didn't show us anything really live from the headset. And so many people have come to me and said, well, but the demonstrations and the things that they showed us were generated by the headset. Like, but that can't be true unless they were heavily edited and doctored. And how do we know this? Because every single time you're in a first-person view of what you see in a VR headset, you do not have perfectly, fluidly, smooth, calibrated movements to look between your windows. So even if it was generated by the headset, that is not how you're going to experience that when you put it on your head. Apple just shy of misrepresenting their product and how their product works. They do that demo of, I'm looking at a panorama photograph, and it's wrapped all the way around my brain. That's not how VR works in rendering an image and positioning that image in space in front of you. You emotionally want to feel like that's how it works, but that's not really how it works. And all of their presentations and demonstrations for interacting with their operating system for this headset were things that we've been doing on mixed reality headsets for 5 or 6 years now. I have a really cheap Acer headset that I put on my face, and if I want, I can go through all of my digital content like I'm at a beachfront condo. Just wonderful, beautiful open space with birds chirping, and there's an ocean over by the rocks, and I can move to all these different places, and I stick a window out in front of me, and then I can move away from that window. Like, we have a word for what Apple showed, and it's not augmented reality, it's mixed reality. You do not see through the visor. It's not an open window where things are sort of interacting with that space. It's you're seeing the camera feed of your location, and then stuff is getting painted into the digital stream of the camera feed. That's mixed reality. That's not augmented reality. And in true Apple form, they can't just call it mixed reality because other companies already use that word. So what are they calling it instead? It's spatial computing, like Apple Silicon and AirDrop. It's another brand name for a system or a platform or a protocol that we've already had. So the thing I'm really excited about, and I want to give Apple credit, they are going to be experimenting with some pretty exotic technologies. Specifically, those new OLEDs are going to be really cool. I want to see more development of micro OLED technology into our products, into our services, really delivering pixel pitch and visual experiences that the human eye is increasingly going to have difficulty understanding the resolution from reality. Micro OLED is going to be another step that gets us to that future, where it doesn't matter how good or how poor your eyesight is, everybody is going to be getting to a photorealistic, three-dimensionally realistic. Your brain is going to have a hard time knowing what's real and what's fake. That's scary, but it's also really geeky cool. But that's not Apple doing anything magic. think about how many times, if you've been tapped into this space, how many times we've played with different products where, oh, you know, VR, that headset's kind of expensive. It's like $1,000 and you need a really powerful PC to run it. Okay. I think that's a fair criticism. So then Apple is able to wow us with an included headset with a MacBook built into it at $3,500. So if any other company had come out with an all-in-one headset system, why weren't they ever allowed to make more expensive products? Why would the tech press discourage or review in a very sort of mid kind of energy other expensive and premium experiences? Shortly before this, we saw HTC come out with an $1,100 VR MR headset. It has controllers. Okay, sure, I guess that's such a barrier to entry. But the reviews on that are pretty lukewarm. They're pretty milquetoast. So was HTC's problem making something that actually had a consumer application and a reasonable price point to get people into a nicer VR MR experience? That's what they were complaining about? Should HTC have come out and said, hey, we've got exotic screens now, $2,500. We're going to go $2,500. And I wonder what the reaction to a mixed reality HTC headset would have been, because up to that point, if anyone made a product more expensive than the Oculus Quest, it got this kind of, I mean, it is a little bit better and the visual fidelity, but you can buy a Quest 2 for like $300. So why should you spend more if you can get a Quest? Oh, I mean, I know, yeah, the Quest doesn't have the same visual fidelity and it doesn't have as much processing power, but it's $300. And that's what always happens in these tech conversations. Every other company, it's a race to the bottom. And tech reviewers only acknowledge value in a product that does more, but can somehow also still achieve some kind of disruptive price. If you want a disruptive price, that means the company is raking your personal data. That's how Oculus made a disruptive price for the Quest. We care about privacy or security or any of these other issues with a platform that leaks your personal information like crazy. Oh, but it's cheap. It's a $300 headset. How could anyone charge more for a VR headset? But then Apple comes out, and there's definitely like criticisms and the eye-watering price tag, but every single criticism just reinforces why only Apple is ever allowed to come out with this product. And so many people in my replies, well, one, what you need to understand is it's a totally new platform. No, they're showing us mixed reality that we've been able to do for 5 or 6 years now. They didn't show us any augmented reality. They showed us none. Some people talked about some experiences that might be the beginnings of AR, but when Microsoft showed off HoloLens 7 years ago, we saw real room and body tracking. 7 years ago, we saw real AR. And this is also going to be one of those educational hurdles. So here's something really funny. Because again, Apple can suck all the air out of the room. I am excited for those micro OLEDs in a VR sense. I think this is going to be a really good step up. When I can get a $1,999.99 MR headset with micro OLEDs, I don't want the visor. I don't want it to be built out of heavy metal and glass. I want a better battery system. I want it to be a mixed reality headset all in one. And hopefully using a next generation Qualcomm SoC. Right? What those new Orion cores or whatever they're called. When I can get that at $2,000, it's a laptop on my head with higher fidelity screens, I think we'll have a beautiful, a next generation VR and MR experience. Awesome. The funny thing about augmented reality versus mixed reality. I don't care as much about my peripheral vision in augmented reality. So when you have this headset, you've got 4K displays on each eye, but you have to spread all of those pixels out with a much wider field of view because you want it to be immersive. But that means your pixel pitch is actually really small. That's actually not good for the visual fidelity of doing something like getting work done. And here's the hilarious part. So these are my Enreal. These are $350. My box says Enreal. The company name is now Xreal. So these are much lower resolution displays. It's basically 1080p. It's full HD per eye. Well, that's not as good. The Apple headset is 4K displays per eye. But the Apple displays are 4K at a much wider field of view. So this is only like a 50-degree field of view, whereas I think the Apple headset is like 100 or 110 or something like that. So when you look through these glasses, you see a much more contained rectangle of information. It looks like a computer monitor floating out in space in front of you. But in that computer monitor, you actually have a higher resolution and a higher pixel per degree than you're going to have on the Apple headset. So when Vision Pro is being sold as a way to, you know, mirror your MacBook screen or really engage with you can do Microsoft Word and Excel through the Vision Pro. When you look at your spreadsheet and your spreadsheet is a contained floating window in space in front of you, you will actually have lower visual fidelity than on a $350 pair of these more simplified, they call them AR or XR glasses. So for $3,500, you have much better peripheral vision, but you have lower image quality in the main field of view occupying the center of your vision. And that's the thing. We're going to have to explain all of this to consumers because Apple marketing is muddying the waters on what the real capabilities of products that you can buy right now. These are out in the channel. You can go and buy an HTC Vive. You can go and buy a Valve Index. You can buy the Xreal and the Rokid and the TCLs for these simple AR experiences, for these simple glasses. But if it's about being practical, the Vision Pro isn't showing us a practicality that we can achieve at 1/10 the cost of what Apple's going to sell the Vision Pro for. So it is very frustrating because every single time this happens, you never are able to complete the educational correction. Apple can put this message out at a scale no other company can match. They can pour hundreds of millions of dollars into advertising. And if any of the tech press steps out of line or criticizes Apple too directly or just isn't enough of a fan of Apple, they get blacklisted. And you can catch the video from John Redinger explaining how he complained about real software issues. I think it was on the iPhone XR. And Apple came out and said, you need to take this down and you're not invited to our events anymore. And like these were legitimate concerns on a phone that he bought with his own money, and Apple still came in as punitive as they possibly could. So it's really bad. I kind of feel we're doomed. Apple can ratchet influence over the conversation on all these products. The one I pointed out in my editorial video that killed me was Apple like, oh, and you don't need bulky controllers. Okay. But who are you talking about? Because HoloLens is augmented reality and it has hand tracking. So you can't be talking about HoloLens. So you have to be talking about VR and MR. And that's what Vision Pro is. It's a mixed reality headset that currently has almost no augmented reality application. So you're picking on VR and MR, where the press for the last couple months has been preaching the downfall of VR, and it's a failed platform, and only Apple can save it, even though the Oculus is selling at rates near the Xbox consoles, and that the PlayStation VR 2 doubled its expectations in sales in its first fiscal quarter. But sure, only Apple can save VR until you want to play a game. Literally, like the parts of the presentation were side by side. Maybe not as comedically as I'm making it sound in my brain, but it was like, you don't even need bulky controllers. But if you want to play a crappy iPad game on a large screen where your TV would have been, you can pick up a PlayStation controller to play a mobile game in a floating window like it would be on a TV. On your $3,500 headset. I feel, even though I did not put the headset on my face, I feel I have every right to complain about that presentation. I feel some ire regarding some of the breathless pontification and the promise of what's to come from some of my friends in the tech press. The same people who regularly tell us, don't buy a product for what the company promises is going to come in the future. Only buy for what it can do today. Never put your faith in these manufacturers. And I have people in my comments, no, but Juan, this is spatial computing. It's the promise of what to come. It's like the first iPhone. The first iPhone wasn't great, but then they improved on it and it got better. And now it's a smartphone revolution. I'm not going to spend $3,500 on what it might do in the future based on what Apple showed me it could do today, being well behind all of the competitors in this space. And I don't think you should either, unless you're considering being a developer for this platform. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. And I have a lot of respect for that. Get the new hardware, play with it, try to create the experiences that Apple has fundamentally failed to provide. And what do we call that? We call that a dev kit. The Vision Pro. After years of hype, how many years have we been waiting for Apple to save VR? And they delivered a really, really expensive mixed reality dev kit. I feel if you're underwhelmed by that, your feelings are valid. And no one around the tech press trying to write these articles on the promise of spatial computing and using all of Apple's flowery brand names and marketing speak should be able to tell you that it's not okay for you to be a little underwhelmed by that eventuality. Let me take one more drink of coffee and we're going to bounce out of this. I got to like go outside and maybe see if I can play with my neighbor's puppy, because this week has been pretty tough. Just one comment. McCorkerin is saying, $3,500 to wear that thing 2 hours a day to browse the internet to watch a movie. It seems so wasteful. My favorite part of the presentation. So it's this gentleman at like a cafe or maybe a makerspace, and he's got his Vision Pro on. And of course, he's wearing it all day, right? He's wearing it to walk around this makerspace, but he's got his MacBook in front of him, and he opens up his MacBook and he like looks at the MacBook screen, and then it copies to his Apple, his Vision Pro, and he can add extra monitors. And you're like, how far we've come that now I can use two whole computers to replicate the use of using one whole computer. This is the big, amazing pitch. And you know, like the thing about mixed reality is it can do some really cool things that help offload, you know, like, so you don't need to carry multiple monitors, right? I've got like a whole shelf down here of laptop docks and part-time laptop battery powered displays, or I've got like a gorgeous, it's a 1080p OLED. It's a beautiful portable screen. But it takes up about as much space as a laptop. So to carry a laptop and a screen takes up about two laptops worth of space in your bag. Okay, a mixed reality headset can do that really well. a $3,500 face computer to replicate the experience of having a couple other monitors out in space in front of you. And do you know what else can replicate that experience? A $350 wearable display. I just started, I kind of snuck a copy of the X-Real Windows beta. They have an app for their X-Real Air glasses. It's pretty janky. I'm not recommending people buy X-Real for this experience, but for it being a beta, last night, I'll plug them into my Surface Laptop Go 2, USB cable directly there. I've got a long enough cable that I can kind of move around my table. And then I told the software like how far out I wanted the displays to be. And I kind of wanted them to just sort of scan directly up from my laptop screen. And I technically had a quad monitor display. And I had Coming to America playing on one screen. I had a document right in front of me. And I had a web browser off to the side. And I'm watching the movie and I'm listening on the little earpiece speakers and I'm writing my script. And I look over at the browser just to get some more information. And I bring it back. And it was incredibly functional. It needs polish. It definitely needs to be smoothed out for how twitchy it is at your head movements. The head tracking is a little futzy. And there could also be some improvements too. Like it would be nice if you could change maybe the refresh rate on these glasses. But for $350, something tells me it's in nearly the same beta tester state as Apple's $3,500 Vision Pro for just popping some screens out in space in front of you and using your laptop with a multi-monitor virtual array. It's that close. And when I'm looking at the document, I actually have a higher resolution on that document than I would have on the Vision Pro. It's ridiculous. And again, it kills me because people don't know what experiences they could already be playing with. And even with 0 degrees of head tracking, like just having a static monitor that follows you no matter where you look, and you're kind of like, it's just sort of in your face all the time. Even that by itself, so nice. Plug it into a Steam Deck, plug it into a Nintendo Switch, let some other computer be the computer and then use this as the displays. Why are we using two computers to get one computer's worth of work done? I don't get it. I really don't. Especially because like on the Vision Pro, you're not going to tether wirelessly over long distances. So it's not like I'm going to set up my laptop in a cafe and then walk across the street and just leave my laptop there. If I'm going to be close to the laptop, and I already have a cable because the Vision Pro has its battery on a cable, I might as well just be tethered on a cable to the computer and experience it that way. Anyway, I could go on. Yeah, I'm a corker, and everyone was already used to owning a phone and carrying it with them. It makes me so sad that Google gave up on Daydream. Again, yet another product ahead of its time. It needed some polish. It just needed 2 generations better SoCs, like from the Snapdragon 820 to the Snapdragon 845. Just imagine what we could have had in a consumer accessible basic VR headset that was powered off of your phone. But nope, instead we have to own 6 computers to do the work of 3. I can't, it's just so much e-weight. We're gonna let this go. I want to just circle back in our closing thoughts here. Your favorite content creators, channels of all sizes, they really need your help. We are passionate fans of folks that have like 5 million subs. They're not getting the traffic that they used to. We're incredibly engaged with creators with like 500,000 subs. Their communities are withering. And then we've got a whole slew of up-and-comers and people getting started and trying to build and find their voice. And algorithms are crushing those people. It is so much rarer to find those beautiful moments of spontaneous or going viral success. They really need your help. They really need your support. It's not a me thing. This isn't me being sad about closing down my subreddit. This is what my Reddit stood for, was embracing a community that has given me so much, has changed my life, has redirected the entire course of my profession and my career, and has given me access and opportunities to amazing things, all because I was there to support and contribute and interact and collaborate with people that have become my friends, even if we've never met face to face. Your favorite creators need your help, and they're not going to get it from the platforms. It cannot be on the creators to affect change. The platforms will crush anyone who steps outside of what the platform is trying to prioritize. They need your help. This is very, very difficult stuff to produce regularly. And if you want that good content and you want that fun content and you want to dig into the meatier discussions and conversations, your favorite creators need your help. So I want to thank everybody who's tuning in on all of the various platforms that I might not be allowed to stream on in the future if these terms of services keep changing on us. I really want to thank all the people that were regularly contributing and upvoting and commenting on Glowing Rectangles. You are the folks who made that community so successful. I provided a platform. I tried to stay out of the way of the platform, and you rose to the occasion and made it something that I lived on every single day. And I don't know how to function on my phone without being able to push the Reddit is fun button and see that community and get the updates on my favorite content creators, and it's driving me crazy. I'm relearning muscle memory because of Reddit's API changes here. But thank you. I hope you'll continue that mission on any other social media platforms or services that you choose to engage with. I hope that you won't stop that mission just because one silly little web page is being difficult. The mission matters more than the platform. So on that note, we've got a lot coming up. I've got an amazing tablet review that's going to be coming up. I've got the bones of my script finished for my Xiaomi 13 Ultra versus Xperia 1 Mark V camera comparison. And I've got the initial script ready for my Xiaomi 13 Ultra camera deep dive. That'll be a Patreon exclusive. Those are humongous videos to put together. That is so much work. It's been kicking my butt pretty hard. And I'm really excited to finally be able to share that with folks over the next week and maybe into early next week. So stay tuned. We've got some fun stuff. Amidst all of this chaos and turmoil, we've got some fun stuff coming. So I want everybody out there to have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care of yourself so you can continue to take care of others. I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.